Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and I don't know if you ever feel like you have the soul of an adventurer. If you do, going to foreign lands would not be a big thing. In our world today, we don't think twice about flying from here to Australia, to China, to Africa, to South America, to wherever. It's a part of our culture. But what if you were living in times when to get mail, it might take weeks or months. To get from point A to point B, anywhere in the world, could take you not just days, but maybe months. How much of an adventurer do you think you would be? Well, today we're going to be talking with Carolyn and Dennis Buckmaster. They are the authors of a book called Healing, Romance, and Revolution. It's all about an American nurse who in 1926 found herself in China. Welcome, Carolyn and Dennis.
Well, hi, Donna. How are you?
Thank you.
Well, I'm doing wonderfully. Are you enjoying the sunshine here in the Pacific Northwest? It's blinking for a little bit.
Don't you think?
I think so. We need to dry out the moss, I'll tell you. Especially on the brain. This book was very interesting to me. These are letters that a fascinating woman by the name of Harriet Smith wrote home. She ended up going over to China and working there for a while. And her letters I found fascinating because it's a whole different time frame. She's very young, she's naive in many ways, yet at the same time she's so down-to-earth practical. It's phenomenal.
She was an absolutely remarkable woman. The first time I met her, I knew I was in the presence of a very exceptional person, and when it came time to get married, I figured that any woman that had a Harriet Smith in their family had to be a good person. So it was a deal maker, that Harriet.
Well, I can imagine. Now, Carolyn, you are Harriet's great niece, am I correct?
That's right.
Now, how did you get all of these letters? Because, I guess it was a different time. Today, we've got email, we don't think about anything, but there was that time when the only way you could communicate, I mean, she didn't have a telephone, and you had to write these letters.
Yes. She sent them home to her parents and said, I'm not going to keep a journal or a diary. These letters are considered that. So save them for me, which is what they did. And over the years, they were passed to different family members. And I ended up with them from my mother.
Amazing.
They really started going through these.
And then her brothers had a couple boxes, too, stored in their garages. And Carolyn reminded them of the boxes, and they said, when can you come get them? And so we went and got them right away.
Oh,
and then we stored them in our garage for another several years, and periodically we'd go in there and peek in the boxes and think about what was in there, but we tried to read her letters, and her handwriting was just terrible. And so it was daunting to try to read the letters, even though we knew there was a gold mine of information there.
Absolutely, because...
Yeah, and then we found, as I dug down in the boxes one day, I found 2 3-ring notebook binders where she had retyped her letters using a god-awful old typewriter, portable typewriter with bent keys and dried out ribbon. She was very frugal, so she never changed a ribbon in that thing, but it was just enough so you could read them more easily. And then we found out what a great gold mine there really was in those letters.
Well, she was very much a detailist in so many ways from what I read in these letters. Now, I want my listeners to know that she was what they called tours of duty with the Yale in China program, and that's Yale, like Yale University, Y-A-L-E, and it was in Changsha, Hunan Province, China, and she was there in 1921 to 24, and then 1926 to 27, and she was right in the midst of the Cultural Revolution that was taking place prior to Mao coming into power. And it's so interesting because of the way she observed things. She had a particular perspective where she would talk about the realities of what was going on, but yet you could tell in her letters as the actions started to occur, she was maturing at a very rapid rate, which war has a tendency to do that to people. And she was very candid in her descriptions of many things.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that we were quite amazed at when we first got into these letters is, and her memorabilia, she had her senior annual from Mount Holyoke. And there was a picture of her with a little write-up about her and whether they weren't sure whether Mount Holyoke's quiet green was ready for her demagoguery and radicalism and waving the flags of the IWW, the Wobblies of the world and so forth. So she had quite a background and attachment to some pretty radical organizations and politics as a young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And her cousin had preceded her to Yale and China program there in Changsha. And I kind of figured that the family encouraged her to follow Cousin Harold to give the family name a rest after all of her political activities that she had been involved with.
I think she represents so strongly what often occurs with a younger generation that has
an idealism.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, just that everything is supposed to be absolutely perfect and absolutely fair, which it never is, and they don't have enough life experience under their belt to really be able to see, yet at the same time, their enthusiasm and willingness to embrace change, contrary often to the older generation, is less than desirable. But she did a turnaround on a lot of her position.
As you mentioned, her maturity during the time that she was in China, it was just absolutely remarkable in how she matured into such an effective leader and manager. And yet she always had a sense of right and wrong and idealism throughout her life.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. Now, what I found so amazing in this book are the photographs. And it takes
you
us
can
back
thank with, Carolyn for that.
Well, Carolyn, you did a marvelous job. People loved the Titanic. The Titanic movie portrayed an era, and it was tragic. It was horribly tragic. Yet the passion, of course, it made it into a phenomenal love story, but the awareness of how science and technology can go awry, especially due to human error, is very strong relative to that story. But here you've got this photograph of the SS President Jefferson, and that's where she was, that's how she was traveling. That's how she would get across the waters. And as I mentioned in the beginning of the show, we don't think twice about getting on a plane and 4 hours we're here. 17 hours, you can be in India. I mean, Australia, it's the same. There's just almost an anxiousness of how can we even speed it up faster than what it is. And I know my grandparents didn't have that luxury. But by golly, here you are with this mode of travel. They talk about the things that occurred and on the SS President Jefferson. She talks about the 155 dead Chinese that were on the ship that were being taken home for burial.
Another six coffins in case any more died along the way.
Yes. I mean, these are things that we just don't know how to relate to because it's not anywhere in our capacity of observation, number one. And number two, it's like, oh, no, that was the old days.
I found it so humorous in an early part of the book when she left Victoria and they got out of the straits just as they'd were going to sleep, and they hit the windstorm and rough water out there, and her stateroom started to do the Charleston. And I'm sure it did the Charleston all the way across the North Pacific in the middle of the winter to Japan. And as you mentioned, the time frame was, I don't know, it was probably 2 or 3 weeks to get across the North Pacific to Japan. And then she had to, they re-coaled the ship, refueled it with coal, and then she went down to Shanghai, and then she had another 900 miles to go from Shanghai to Changsha on the Yangtze and Zhang River. So travel was not a comfortable experience back then.
Well, I think with history, I mean, today we don't have smallpox vaccines that we insist everybody take, but then you did because it was a very cholera, diphtheria, whooping cough. I mean, every communicable disease you were going to be brought in contact with. And she talks about how she was vaccinated for smallpox, but she was on the Wuchang. There was a school in Wuchang, and you mention in your book, you have interesting notes all through your book, that it's located on the south bank of the Yangtze River at the confluence of the Han River opposite Hankou and Hanyang. And I wonder if it still exists. Is it still there now that they've built the dam?
Oh, I wouldn't know. Changsha is certainly still there. Is that what you're referencing?
Well, I was thinking of Wuchang, W-U-C-H-A-N-G.
I'm sorry, I think it's still there.
Okay.
I think the Three Gorges Dam is further upriver from that.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be my my recollection.
Now, she managed to get some photographs, which I found fascinating to look at the photographs that were there, and then the story about Dr. Louise Farnham. Now, for those of you listening, can you imagine this is a time when women who, if they had gone to medical school, if they had the title of doctors, if they had a PhD, which I believe Dr. Farnham had, she was just a very intelligent woman, they weren't respected very much. It was like, so what? You're a woman. It doesn't count. She was quite brave herself to go to China, Dr. Farnham.
Oh, absolutely. And Harriet and Louise were very, very good friends. And Louise Farnham stayed in China after Harriet left, and she was there another 10 years before the Japanese came in and took over most of China during the war. And then she had to leave. She was a really remarkable woman, and she was the first woman to graduate from the University of Yale Medical School.
That was
an
incredible
story. And the little story about that is for her to get into the medical school, so part of her admission, her father had to pay for the construction of a woman's restroom in the school there, because part of that, they'd never had any women studying in the School of Medicine.
That's right. They wouldn't permit it. They absolutely forbid it. Boy, am
I
glad they did too.
Yale was a boys' school, and Mount Holyoke was for girls.
Now, you have an amazing story in your book, and it was about a medical student who was an intern from Suzhou, and there was a woman who had had a baby the night before. She had an old, dirty coolie shoe tied onto the placenta cord, and they found this woman had excessive fluid and a twin, quite premature, seemed to be dead. The doctor in charge left when the patient was returned to the ward, but there was a medical student named Liu and saw the baby that had been put in a garbage bucket, fished it out, and after working with this baby for an hour, it came back to life.
Yeah, and then he kind of accepted the baby as his own baby, a child, and took it into his residence and wrapped it up in a blanket or something, went and played tennis. But Harriet really liked that intern, that he was a very sensitive young man and very caring. And he was the one that brought the little 9-year-old girl into the hospital that looked like she was 80 years old. Do you recall that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And she had smallpox, and they vaccinated the whole ward for smallpox. And then the next day, she passed 46 worms, and then she died.
Mm-hmm.
And Harriet said something. She didn't know how many more animals she might have had inside her, and they would probably do an autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that very interesting. The health conditions, the illnesses that you mentioned earlier, including things like even like leprosy, that she and her and the people at the hospital had to deal with on a daily basis, let alone wounds of from the war and just the normal things that people, broken bones and stuff. But
mm-hmm.
that was a very busy place.
Yes, it was a busy place, and they were one of the few facilities around that could even offer any kind of treatment. And also what she talks about is the flooding. Now, I'm not an expert on Chinese history, but I remember as a youngster hearing about flooding in China. Sometimes millions of people died. And
absolutely,
it wasn't
yeah.
just from the flooding, it was from starvation, because if their rice fields were flooded at the wrong time, they had absolutely no food available. And that is something I think in our world today that people just don't get it. And boy, I can remember my grandparents talking about how you had to have food put aside. This was mandatory, but they had gone through the Depression. And I can remember listening to those stories, and they were farmers. My grandparents came off of farms, and they were very, very attentive to making sure that they had food stored. And I learned later this was not uncommon in Virginia. A lot of people had the same attitude. Because
and then Harriet, she yeah. was there during the 1 year they'd have drought, and the next year they'd have floods, and some years they'd have both floods and drought. And
mm-hmm.
it was a you could see through her writings there was a constant struggle for the Chinese people to feed themselves, and so starvation and disease was very prevalent.
When we read history like this, many times when you are sharing stories of this nature with a younger generation, if they have never, ever had to deal with anything like this, if they have no understanding of farming, if they have no understanding about how the weather affects crops, worms, this type of thing, it's amazing how big their eyes get when they start hearing stories like this. They go, that can't, no, that has to be make-believe. But it isn't. It isn't.
That's true.
In the first box of books that we received, we grabbed some for our grandkids, our sons and grandchildren, so they get a wonderment of Harriet and what she went through and her experiences and what an adventuresome, bright relative they come from, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Very proud of that.
Well, there are so many aspects of the culture that she brings out, and one of the biggest aspects of the culture, which she felt often was a detriment to the Chinese people, and this was her opinion, of course, was the old established tradition of losing faith. This is something where they wouldn't stand up against people. Now, of course, then they went through the other extreme under Mao and his group. But it's a fascinating read, looking at her perspective and seeing and pointing out the various cultural components that kept a lot of people in a positioning of servitude. But the one thing she emphasizes over and over again is that the Chinese people were a peaceful people. Now,
yes,
with history, you don't hear very much of that. But that's true. The Asian people are really a peaceful people in general.
Yeah, and she, one thing that became very evident throughout the book, too, is how much she loved the Chinese people,
mm-hmm,
and the country itself. And she loved to go on her pony rides out in the country through the rice fields along the rivers, and she did a lot of hiking in the mountains with her colleagues and so forth, and going to picnics, and she loved the culture, the land, and everything about her experience in Changsha in China.
You have a photo in here, Carol, that shows the hospital ambulance.
Oh.
Which is... That, I looked at that.
That's,
and I,
great,
said, yes, that is just like a pallet with two poles on either side and men carrying it. And that was the hospital ambulance.
With a little tent covering over it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Kind of puts Medic One in perspective, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And then you have photos in here of Chinese peasants who are in these round boats, because their whole village, everything has been flooded. And she was fascinated with the fact that the people just didn't get all that upset over it, because they've been through it so many times. This has been happening in China for thousands of years, and they just go, well, we just have to go back and fix it up until the next time. And she made so many observations, and being an American and being educated as she has been, many of the Chinese people were not educated.
Yes, that's true.
And yet many of them were. And then, of course, she really loved her role as an educator at the nursing school there at the Yale in China program.
She brings out information, too, in her letters about how the Russians were very, very much involved in the revolutionary upheaval in China.
Yeah, they were a source of a lot of agitation, and she would marvel at how little bit of money they invested in their propaganda and how far it went.
Mm-hmm.
But the different revolutionary armies had, each of the generals had their own Russian advisor. So they were troublemakers way back then, for sure.
Fascinating. Now, I know Shanghai at the time, and you have information in here in her letter on Chiang Kai-shek. There are photos in here. She brings out a story about the unearthing of an old tomb from the Han Dynasty. Tell us about that.
Well, it was a house along the... a home or house along the riverbank, and during one of these flooding periods, the bank got washed away, and when it washed away, it opened up this kind of like a basement that had been sealed, and they went inside of it, and they were able to determine that it was from the Han Dynasty. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Yeah, and... it was quite a find, and there was no archaeologist in the way we have now, or anybody to preserve it, and there wasn't too much in there, but it was just the idea that it went back so many centuries, 5, 6, 7, 8 centuries or something of that nature, and everybody, there was some kind of like bricks that were made out of some kind of metal or pewter-like thing. And,
pewter or silver. That area evidently had silver, Chinese silver.
Yeah.
And so we're not quite sure what this brick kind of stuff was made of. But she decided, well, maybe she'd take one.
Yeah. As long as all the rest of the tomb robbers were in there. She decided to take one or two for herself. So she had a little devilish streak about her, too. And
we've never seen it, never heard of it before. And in all of her belongings after she died, nothing. We have no idea whatever happened to it.
You know, one of the other things that really remarkable, along with her professional work, with the hospital and the nursing and the teaching of nurses and the management of the nurses and so forth, she also found time to be enterprising, and she was buying the Oriental rugs and sending them home, and linen and lace. And then she had an arrangement with the intern, Lou, that he would collect pheasant feathers, and she would send those home for millinery work in the stateside. And then she'd pay him with American tobacco products, which they didn't know were bad for you back then. And so she had this little import-export international trade business going on while she was doing everything else. And then her romances, I mean, this lady is, I don't know where she got the energy.
She was younger. She wasn't in her 50s.
That's right.
She was younger. Carolyn, I wanted to ask you a question. Hmm. Here you are as the great niece of this incredible woman that very few people would even know about. You do, because she's part of your family, and obviously now you've got this wonderful book, and because of her being just a fascinating lady, she was working at the University of Washington. A lot of students got to know her, so she affected the lives of thousands of people. How did this affect you? What was the most impressive, significant effect that you had after going through these letters?
Oh, goodness. I think, and pretty much for the whole family, none of us knew about what went on over there, really. We knew she'd been there, and she taught nursing. That was kind of how we all grew up. But nobody thought to ask her about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was it was so fascinating finding out all about her. And here we thought we knew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she was had been in the family for 90 years by the time she died, and everybody just kind of accepted her, and we knew she had done interesting things and had gone to China, and her professionally she was very active with the nurses and so forth, but we just became so comfortable with her that nobody thought anything about it, you know, too much. But mm-hmm. then we got into her letters, and we really discovered the full depth and breadth of her experience and her wisdom and her sense of humor, which we always knew she had a nice sense of humor. But to find that it was alive and well back in 1926, it was just a revelation for the entire family.
Well, when one...
A whole different person.
Yes. When one reads the book...
She may have been the same person, but we appreciated her a whole bunch more.
Yes, I bet. Now, I know we're just about out of time here, but one of the things I want to mention, when you read a book and you're in the time frame, it really makes you aware of how much she saw and experienced before she left this earth at the age of 90, and the very amazing things that evolved, and yet, in many respects, how very little has changed with human nature. What's your website that people can go to find out more about Aunt Hat?
Aunt Hat, yeah. The website is www.healingromancerevolution.com.
Healingromancerevolution.com. If you want to read about something that is true, no fabrication here, you will find so many parallels between what went on in 1926 and what's going on in the world today. It's really
the radical students that she had to deal with, and radical unions, and they would have demonstrations outside of the office or the school and the hospital, and they'd be chanting, "Down with imperialism, down with capitalism, mm-hmm. down with the Commodore classes, down with this, down with that." And you just change a few words and you got Occupy Wall Street. And so, these things just go over and over and over again.
Yes, Carolyn and Dennis Buckmaster, thank you so much for being my guest. Check out this website, healingromancerevolution.com. The book is absolutely fascinating. The photography, the living history that she recorded, this wonderful woman called Aunt Hat Harriet H. Smith. Thank you both for being with me. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008, and I'll be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Perhaps it's because as I'm getting older, I have more time available, but because of doing the show, I really find history absolutely amazing. And when you come across material like the guests that I've just interviewed, where letters are found, information is brought forward that maybe you had no idea was even there, it opens up a window to life that is just absolutely fascinating. So I'm so glad they were able to join me and that they've taken the time to put the material together. And so many of you out there may have family members that have had experiences that you yourself may never have, but if you can record them, and if you can listen to their stories and put them together in some way where you can pass it along to other members of your family, maybe put a book together like this couple did, or have an album that can be shared with friends. It's really amazing what you learn. I have a very dear friend up in Alaska, and her mother was, not her mother, her grandmother, was raised in the Midwest. And her grandmother lived to be close to 100 years of age. Well, her grandmother one day said she'd be happy to share with my friend her stories. And so my girlfriend, what she did, she set up a video camera, and she talked to her grandmother. She said, "Grandma, I want you to just realize I want to film this." And this, I think, was 15 years ago when she did it. And she also had a recorder, so she asked her questions. What was it like when you were growing up? What happened? Now, her grandmother didn't travel to different parts of the world, but she was dealing with a lifestyle and with growing things on a farm and other items that my girlfriend's grandkids are never, ever probably going to be dealing with. And my girlfriend put this all together, and she's got a legacy that she's now able to pass along to her granddaughters that otherwise would have no idea about the family history. And she said when she finished doing all of the work, she said, "I was so amazed. I found myself thinking of questions. What about this? What about that? What were the rules of etiquette? What did you do? How did you handle medical challenges?" And all of these things she was able to ask. And so she said there was no such thing as you don't ask a question about this, that, or the other. And her grandmother was just completely open, and she was surprised by how much information she shared. And she's doing the same thing with her mom. And so what's happening is there's this story that she's putting together. And she said, "One day I want to have this all ready for my granddaughters so that they will know about the family that they've come from, at least on her side." And she said, "It'll mean a lot to them at some time. Because when you find out about certain members of family, some of them are real scoundrels." Whew, that's wonderful to talk about anyway. I've got a girlfriend that some relative of hers was hung by the Confederate Army. So you never know what's going to come up in your family tree. But it makes for interesting information. So I know there's DNA testing and all kinds of stuff, but it's the stories of people and their everyday living that really make you, I think, appreciate where you are and what has been accomplished in the time frame that they lived in and where you are right now. I wanted to share a story with you. And by the way, you can give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. In 1939, one of the most unique and fascinating treasures was discovered. Who discovered it? Well, it was a landowner, Edith Pretty, and a museum curator, Guy Maynard. Now, what they found was shared with Charles Phillips, who was working at a Swellen college. Now, at Sutton Hoo, this was Pretty's estate, Phillips saw a huge open trench revealing a buried boat. The ship had been brought 800 yards inland from the river. It was 90 feet long and had rows of iron rivets every 6 inches and lines of gray-black powder every 3 feet where the ribs were. There was a burial chamber on this ship. It was packed with treasure, and it was right in the middle of the ship. Grave robbers had never found this. Now, how did this come about? How did they discover the ship? Well, the story is an interesting one. In the early 1930s, there was a ghostly figure that was walking around Edith Pretty's property. And she noticed this figure, and she got curious. Now, on Edith's property, there were these mounds. They'd been there forever. She didn't think much about them. But because she saw this person wandering around, she decided she was going to get in touch with Maynard and local archaeologist Basil Brown. She knew her property was quite old, and her gardener and gamekeeper were invited in to excavate where this ghostly figure had been wandering. Now, at one point, Brown was told that he wasn't to dig anymore and to wait for other experts, but he ignored it, and he is the one that discovered the burial chamber. In 17 days, they pulled out 263 objects, including a golden garnet pyramid brooch, a solid gold buckle, jeweled and enameled shoulder clasps. They found bone gaming pieces, handmade, items of fur and feathers. They hadn't disintegrated. Usually your fur and feathers, you know, not going to make it. But because it had been in mud all of that time, it really created a seal, so the things didn't deteriorate. They found a heap of purple metal, which when they lifted it from the ship and placed it on grass, the mass of purple metal clicked. And it was a chest of some kind. It popped open the top, and inside of it was a nest of 10 silver bowls. Now, they didn't find any kind of human remains. They are not sure. They might have found out more since this incident, but they think it might have been the grave of an East Anglican King Redwald, who died about 625. They say the discovery just matched, coincidentally, what was in the written story of the ancient epic Beowulf. Now, they started exploring some of the other mounds on her property. In those mounds, they found deteriorated and cremated remains of humans and animals. And in one, there was a warrior and his horse. They were in full armor, and they had been buried together. But there's absolutely nothing in that ship that explained who the owners were or where they were from. A link with Egypt? Quite possibly. Fascinating stuff. And you know, with today's technology, they are finding so many things that are buried in underground. And one of the aspects of the story of Harriet that we were discussing in the first part of the show, here she is in China, a flood opens up an area of earth, and they find this building. Well, things like this are happening in Egypt. They're happening in different parts of the world. Throughout the centuries, many times, just like in Greece and in Italy, cities, because of earthquakes or what have you, volcanic eruptions, cities were built on top of cities due to their locale, for whatever reason. And, gee whiz, we're just finding out more and more about ancient sites. So I wanted to share that with you. Donna Sebo here, 888-627-6008. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Dorothy Kramer. This very, very talented lady has put out another book on energy healing. It's called The Healing Touch. Dorothy has been involved with healing, my goodness, for almost all of her life. She's an incredibly talented woman that has so much in the way of skill and intuitive ability. She's just an amazing lady. She's in her late 70s, early 80s, and you'd never know it. She is just as spry and active as anyone could be. So she is a walking demonstration about how one can take care of themselves and enjoy wellness. So tomorrow we're going to be talking with her, and I hope that you'll tune in because I think you'll find her story quite an interesting one and her information in her book, Healing Touch, quite fascinating. Now, I know we're going to go on break in just a moment. I want to remind those of you listening, a new show time for the Donna Sebo Show. I will be coming on air as of May the 1st at 9 o'clock in the morning, Pacific time. So if you're in New York, that'll be noon your time. And this is a change. Again, May the 1st, the Donna Sebo Show is moving to the 9 a.m. slot. So mark it down so that you'll have that handy. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break in just a minute. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. Hey, how about a chicken and a tomatillo enchilada casserole that's not full of fat? Mm-hmm. you like Mexican food like I do, I think you'll want this recipe. We're going to be right back.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007, that's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Before I share the recipe with you for the chicken and tomatillo enchilada casserole, I do want to mention, for those of you who are listening from Western Washington, my Quantum Mind 3 class is going to be coming up on April the 14th, and it is going to be from 10 to 4. The class, the first part of the class, is going to be presented by Robert Newman. We're going to be talking about Chinese medicine, how to use it in everyday life, how it came about, why it's valuable, and understanding about it. And then in the second half, I'm going to be doing a class on dreams, how to work with dreams, techniques to enable you to use them as a tool. Also, we are going to be doing mind exercises, so you will be able to demonstrate to yourself your own intuitive capacities. It's fascinating, it's fun, and it is going to be a class that we are really going to have a good time with. And I know it's just before taxes are due. Hey, why not take the time, relax, have fun, have lunch. Lunch is provided. Class cost is $59.95. Would love to see you there, and it will inspire you beyond expectation. So give me a call at my office, 253-582-5604, if you would like to make the reservation for the class. Okay. I don't know about you, but I love Mexican food. I really do. But so many times when it's prepared, it's extremely fatty. Well, this is not going to be that way. And I think you're going to find that you have all of these yummy, yummy flavors. And you could take this recipe if you want, and you can cut it in half. This serves, maybe about six people, because you're going to have two enchiladas a person. That's the normal serving. So if you wanted to make it half, great. Then you're going to have it for two people and maybe three people, or just have enough for leftovers. You won't have a whole bunch extra. But this is something, even when you fix it, it gets better as it gets older. So here's the recipe. You're going to need 2.5 pounds of fresh tomatillos, and they have to be husked, rinsed, and chopped. No biggie. Then you're going to need 1 cup of chopped scallions, and that's going to be about 4 good-sized scallions. You need a half a cup of chopped fresh cilantro. Now, you really need the fresh here because the fresh gives a whole different taste. And if you don't have fresh and you need to use the dried, then that's what you have to do. But you need the equivalent of a half a cup of the chopped fresh cilantro. You're going to need 1 to 2 jalapeno peppers, seeded and minced, and the heat on the jalapeno, totally up to you. Mild, medium, hot, super hot, it's your choice. But you only need 2 of them. 2 large cloves of garlic, you want to mince those finely. And then you need 3/4 of a teaspoon of salt, 1/4 of a teaspoon of pepper. You're going to need 12 6-inch corn tortillas. You're going to need 2.5 cups of shredded, cooked, skinless chicken breast, or I'd say mix it. If you're like me and you've got people that like dark meat as well as the white meat, go ahead and mix it. Who cares? But you can use a roasted chicken. That'll save you time. You don't have to worry about cooking this yourself. Just go to the store, get yourself one of those nice, fat, plump chickens that are already cooked for a few dollars, and then you've got it ready to go. 12 tablespoons of shredded Mexican cheese blend. If you want it to be less fatty, get the reduced fat Mexican cheese blend. So you're going to need about 12 tablespoons of that. And then 12 tablespoons of fat-free sour cream. Now, if you're not concerned about the fat, use the regular stuff. All it is we're talking about is flavor here. Now, this is what you're going to have to do. You need to preheat the oven to 350 degrees. You're going to need a 13-by-9-inch baking dish, and you want to spray that with cooking spray or oil it well. You're going to puree half of your tomatillos in a food processor, and then you want to stir together the chopped tomatillos, the pureed tomatillos, the scallions, cilantro, jalapeno, garlic, salt, and pepper. Mix that all together, and it's going to be ready to go. Then you take and dip both sides of a corn tortilla in the mixture, put the tortilla on a sheet of foil on your work surface, and then top it with about 3 tablespoons of your chicken, about 1/2 tablespoon of cheese, and 1 tablespoon of sour cream. And then you fold the 2 opposite sides of the tortilla over to enclose the filling. Put your enchilada seam side down in the baking dish. That's what you do with all the rest of the tortillas. Dipping it in the tomatillo mixture, filling it with the chicken and the sour cream and the cheese, and till they're all done. You're going to make 12 enchiladas this way. The remaining tomatillo mixture, you pour it over your enchiladas and sprinkle it with the remaining cheese that you have. And if you're like me, you always put on extra. I love lots of cheese, and especially the spicy cheese. So anyway, you go ahead and you do that, and I would say just know that you're going to have this bubbling. So you want to make sure you cover the baking dish with foil. You're going to bake it at 350 degrees for 25 minutes, and then you uncover it, and you let it bake for maybe, another 10 or 15 minutes. And what's going to happen is the edges of your enchiladas are going to begin to brown. Your cheese is going to melt wonderfully. And when you take it out of the oven, just let it stand for about 5 minutes before you serve it. And then that way, all the juices and everything will come together very nice. The flavors will marry. This is a great dish if you're going to have a potluck. This is a fabulous dish for a potluck. And if you just want to do something for a Mexican-style dinner that is just going to be enjoyed by everyone, this is good. Now, if you don't like chicken, remember, you can substitute any other kind of meat, your beef, pork, lamb, whatever you want. Your meat is your choice. You make the decision on that. But this is a basic recipe that, oh my goodness, I think kids love. And the only thing you ever have to be thoughtful about, because it's got good basic stuff in it, is the heat. Don't make a mistake like I did once. What I did once, I went and opened up a can of jalapenos that were hot. I had no clue how hot they were. I hadn't read the outside of the can relative to the temperature. My guests were drinking milk for hours. So you don't ever want to have something like that happen. So check those cans carefully. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. There are so many adventures we can experience in life, and you need to be unafraid of stepping up to them and letting them happen. A young woman in 1926 did that. You could do the same in your own way, in your own fashion. Life is an adventure. Enjoy it to the hilt. This is Donna Siebel. Talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on BBS Radio. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.